I'm Dan Hughes in the Old Time Radio Corner. Dizzy Dean retired from baseball at the end of the 1947 season, and in 1948 he did a 15-minute weekly summer replacement baseball show on NBC. Dean was one of the all-time great pitchers active from 1930 to 1947. His career was cut short by an injury he suffered in the 1937 All-Star Game. His toe was broken by a line drive, and he tried to come back too soon. His pitching was affected, and he lost a lot of speed on his fastball. Dizzy Dean was the leader of the 1934 St. Louis Cardinals, lovingly known as the Gas House Gang. They were famous both on and off the field, and the shenanigans they pulled are legendary. Dean's record that year was an unbelievable 30-7. In his career, he played for the Cardinals, the Cubs, and the St. Louis Browns, and he entered the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1953. After his retirement from baseball, he did radio play-by-play for both St. Louis teams, the Cardinals and the Browns. On television, he did the CBS Game of the Week from 1955 to 1965. Dean was a down-home country boy who relished his mangling of the English language. He often broke into song on the air, usually singing the Wabash Cannonball. Since his radio commentary show ran just 15 minutes, I've got two episodes for you today, and yes, he sings the Wabash Cannonball in one of them. First, from July 17, 1948, Dizzy discusses the results of the 1948 All-Star Game, which had just been played. And then we'll hear the September 18, 1948 show, where Dizzy names his all-time All-Star team. And now, the Dizzy Dean Show.
Well, here he is again, Dizzy Dean. Brought to you by the makers of Johnson's Wax for Carnu, the wax-fortified auto polish that cleans and polishes your car in one easy application.
Howdy, everybody.
And first of all, Dizzy Dean, how about that All-Star Game? Did it catch you with your prognostications out on a limb?
No, it didn't catch me out on a limb, Frank. I can say without hesitation that I'm proud of the way the game came out.
Now, what do you mean, proud, Diz? As I remember it, you talked about long ball hitters and thought the National League had a good chance.
I'm proud, Frank, because a pitcher won that game. You know, people don't appreciate that a lot of pitchers are very fine hitters. But Vic Rash had done all the pitching, made all the pitchers proud the way he stepped up there and won the 1948 ball game with a base hit. A single with the bases filled. I was mighty glad to see Rash up there in that pinch. And I laughed when some of the experts in the press box around me were saying, "That Bucky Harris. Why don't he send DiMaggio or somebody in there to hit Parashi?" Frank, us pitchers are pretty good hitters. Yes, sir, and a pitcher won this one with a base hit. And you don't have to look far for the hero of this game. It wasn't no long ball hitter. It was just another good hitting pitcher, Vic Rashi.
Well, Diz, there was a lot of talk before and after that game about discontinuing the annual midsummer baseball show because some of the players didn't seem to be displaying too much interest in it. How do you feel about that?
Frank, there was a full house out there in the ballpark. The fans seemed to like it. It put $93,000 in the players' pension fund. I can't see nothing wrong with the All-Star game. Keep on playing's all I can say. I did hear some weeping afterwards about not being such a whale of a ball game. But I noticed the American League crowd wasn't doing no moaning.
No moaning with a record like that. Well, Diz, it's mailbag time now. The letters have been just pouring in. Ben Todd of Batchtown, Illinois, wants to know what you think of the trouble the pitchers have been having this year. And as an old pitcher of parts, Dizzy, have you the answer to Mr. Todd's question?
I sure think I got that answer, Frank. I've been noticing, too, that ball games are running long and the pitchers have been wearing a regular path from the mound to the dugout and from the bullpen to that hill, and maybe vice versa. And every time you look up, there's a count of 3-2 on every hitter.
And what, Professor Dean, is the answer?
I think them home run crazy hitters has got the pitcher scared to death, Frank. It looks like they're scared to let loose of the ball. They stand out there and shake off the catchers, and it looks like they'd rather be tooken up for being just a little bit wild, after all, walking 5 or 10 men, than to have somebody get a couple of base hits.
Well, have you a suggestion, Professor, how we might calm down those pitchers, you know, sort of ease their minds?
Yes, Frank, if the pitchers will quit trying to cut those corners too fine and just powder that ball in there, I think the game will get shorter and you won't need so many pitchers every day. I believe the pitchers have gone crazy about pitching to spots. A good pitcher don't have to worry too much about spots. Let him rear back and fire that fastball in there and break off a few jug-handled curves once in a while, and he'll find those hitters won't get so many doggone home runs. That's what me and Paul used to do. Just fog them in and let the hitters take care of themselves, brother. And that goes for all the good pitchers. Dazzy Vance never worried about anything except getting the ball in the strike zone. Carl Hubble was the same way. There was a great pitcher. You didn't see him ever walk everybody in the ballpark.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Paul back there, Diz, because another letter writer, Frank Crosby of Detroit, Michigan, wants to know if you were just kidding when you said recently that you came up the hard way.
Frank, I'll say me and Paul come up the hard way. When we were kids, we never knew what it was to own a baseball glove. We used yarn from our dad's socks to make a baseball, and we cut a limb off of a hickory tree to make a baseball bat. And when we was picking cotton for 50 cents a day, we never had no time to think about higher education, fifth grade, that is. Boy, we were sure green. You should have seen those cows chasing us when we caught the train. I know we've caught on pretty good since then, but we didn't know much about the world outside of Texas and Arkansas and Oklahoma. I remember one time in New York when we was with the Cardinals. Somebody got kicking about the income taxes we had to pay, and Paul, that's my kid brother, he said, "You know, fellas, we all ought to do something about them taxes. They're too high. And if all the people in this here country would get together and vote the way, I'll bet we'd have things change." Paul said, "You know, there must be a million people in this country." Of course, Frank, I thought I was a lot smarter than Paul because I spoke right up and said, "Don't be silly, Paul. You know doggone well there's more than a million in this great big country. By golly, there must be 9 or 10 million.
Well, Diz, you learn fast.
Yep, Frank, I'm like Sam Nairn. He learned fast.
Oh, another story, huh?
Yes, this is a short one, Frank. You know, Sam Nairn was a young catcher with the Cardinals. Sam thought he was a third baseman, but Branch Rickey told him he was too fat. Third base didn't want him, and he'd better be a catcher. So Sam says, "All right, Mr. Rickey, whatever you say." You get to saying that easy when you around Uncle Branch, too. "Yes, sir, Mr. Rickey." Anyhow, Sam reported at training camp, and Frankie Priest was manager. Sam asked Frank if there was any particular orders for him the first day. And Frank says, "No, Sam, no particular orders. Here's what I want you to do. You pick out some veteran on the club and do whatever he does. If he runs, you run. If he gets in a pepper game, you get in one." Well, about an hour later, Frank is leaning on the batting cage watching the Cardinals hit. And all of a sudden, ducking a foul, he sees Sam Nairn leading on the batting cage, too. "Hey, Sam," Frankie says, "what are you doing here? I thought I told you to pick out some veteran on the club and do whatever he was doing." "That's what I done, Mr. Priest," Nairn tells Frankie. "Who did you pick?" Frankie wanted to know. And Sam Nairn says, "I picked you, Mr. Priest. I've been doing whatever I've seen you done ever since."
Now it's time for Dizzy Dean the Coach. Diz, what advice have you today for ambitious young ball players who'd like to reach the big leagues?
Frank, this is some general advice, and it's for the older boys. I mean those around 16, 17, or 18 years of age who are about ready to try their luck in pro baseball. And first, be sure you're in the best possible playing condition before you go to a tryout school. Get your arms and legs in shape. Get some batting practice. If you possibly can, try to go to a baseball school in midsummer or in the fall. After you had 2 or 3 months of playing baseball, then you'll be able to show your best ability. Second, find out what you can do best. I mean, if you can hound those grounders, try for the infield. If you're extra fast going after them flies, try for the outfield. And brother, if you can hit a ball a long way and often, don't worry. They'll find a place for you. Third, give extra time to practicing on anything that is your weakness. If you're a fine fielder and weak hitter, carry a bat around with you and bat every chance you get. If you're an outfielder who has trouble with ground balls, have somebody to hit grounders to you till you're blue in the face. And fourth, and here's some advice for city governments all over the country. Give those kids baseball fields to play on, folks. Don't have no fancy child delinquency programs. Just give the kids baseball amateurs and the boys will do all right. Nobody ever got into no trouble on a baseball field, except maybe an argument with umpires. And Leo DeRocher and Frankie Frisch will tell you that ain't no serious trouble. If you're worrying about the kids, just look around your town. See if the boys got a place to play baseball. And buy them a few baseballs and bats and gloves. Brother, they'll pay dividends more than all the fancy speech-making you can do.
Well, I know now, Dizzy, why you said you wanted the fathers and brothers to listen to your advice. And now it's about time for you to spin one of your favorite yarns. What is it today, Diz?
That sign business reminds me of one I always got a laugh out of, Frank. It's about Pepper Martin, the greatest one-man show that ever hit a baseball. He was third baseman and outfielder with the old Gas House gang, and boy, was he a character. This one's about Pepper and signs. You know, in baseball, you have signs for everything. The pitch out, the steal, the hit and run, the sacrifice, and the manager usually relays it to a coach who flashes the sign from the coach's box at first to third. Well, one day we're playing the Giants at the Polo Grounds, and we've got a man on third with two out and Pepper Martin at bat, and the Giants leading 2-1 in the ninth. The count works to two strikes and two balls, and of course, under them circumstances, there's only one thing to do. Protect that plate and try for a base hit. We all like to fell off the bench when Pepper puts down a bunt. Pepper could run like a scared rabbit, but the Giant third baseman races in and throws out Pepper by a whisker. That ends the ball game, and when we gets to the clubhouse, Gabby Street, the manager is fit to be tied. He says, "Pepper, I never thought you'd do a thing like that." And Pepper says, "Gracious, Gabby, I was surprised, too, when I got the sign." "Who give you that bunt sign?" says Street. And Pepper says, "Buzzy Wares give it to me." And Gabby says, "Buzzy, did you give the bunt sign?" And Buzzy says, "Yes, you gave it to me, Gabby, and I gave it to Pepper." And Gabby says, "Buzzy, I don't believe you even know the bunt sign." And Buzzy says, "Yes, I do, like this." And Buzzy rubs his hand across his face, and then Gabby did explode. He says, "Buzzy, you pulled a boner. Can't you tell the difference between when a man's giving the bunt sign and when he's just chasing a fly off his nose?"
Well, Diz, these managers really do have their troubles, don't they? And speaking of managers, how about that managerial shakeup in the East yesterday?
Well, Frank, that's something I'm glad to talk about, and it was really a shock to me, and I'm sure it's a shock to a lot of people in baseball all over the country. Nobody even dreamed that Leo DeRocha would be let out as a Brooklyn Dodger and go to the New York Giants. And little Mel Ott, who was manager of the New York Giants, went to the office. Well, I want to say something about those two boys. I played against them, and I played with them. They're two great fellas. And just like baseball men all over the country say, when you're going pretty good, why, the manager's always in there. But if you happen to hit a slump and you have a little bad luck, why, they say, the first thing you say, let's fire the manager. So that's exactly why they made that change, and we can see which is going to do the best, because Bert Schotten managed the ball club in Brooklyn last year. He's back there now as manager. The New York Giants, the Brooklyn Dodgers have changed managers, and they're practically tied for fourth place, about a half a game separating one another. And by the time the season's over, we'll see which one of the clubs prosperous by the change of those managers.
Well, it was certainly, as you say, Diz, a great shock to the baseball world to see all this take place, and all in one day. These two managers, New York and Brooklyn, and then that change in the Philadelphia Phillies, too.
Yes, Ben Chapman's let out, and I want to say that there's another great friend of mine, a great ball player, and I thought he was doing all right as a manager. But as I said a minute ago, you know, when you get to going bad, why, the manager's the first fellow they fire. And the Phillies got off to a great start under Ben Chapman, and he was right up there 1.5 and 2 games out of the first place for the first 40 or 50 ball games. Then they went into a little slump, and then they let Chapman out yesterday. And after all, he had a young ball club, and he's going to have a good ball club one of these days, but I think they're a year or two away.
Well, have you any idea what he's going to do now, Diz?
Well, Frank, he's got a bowling alley, and I think he'll go down there and run his bowling alley.
He lives down there in Birmingham, Alabama, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He lives in Birmingham. And speaking of Birmingham, you know, Ben was out, just let out yesterday, and he's probably got down there just in time this morning for that rebel convention they're having down in Alabama.
Well, folks, we certainly hope you'll be right back with us at this same time next week to listen to Dizzy Dean, brought to you by Johnson's Car New, a wax-fortified auto polish that cleans and polishes your car in one easy application. Rub it on, and Car New zips away road film that water won't touch. Wipe it off, and Car New polishes your car. Gives the whole body a new car luster. Car New your car today. And then tomorrow, you'll breeze down the highway in a car with a real Sunday shine. Remember, rub it on and wipe it off is all you do with Car New.
And this is old Dizzy, hoping all you folks are on the stands this time next Saturday. I'll be pitching my cross again for Johnson's Car New.
This is Frank Eschen saying goodbye until next Saturday for the makers of Johnson's Wax Fortified Auto Polish, Car New. The Dizzy Dean Show came to you from KSD St. Louis. Dizzy Dean, brought to you by the makers of Johnson's Wax. For Carnu, the wax-fortified auto polish that cleans and polishes your car in one easy application.
Howdy, folks. Oh, listen to the jingles, the rumble and the roar. As she travels on the highway and down by the shore. She's mighty tall and handsome. She's known quite well by all. But she's a combination on a Wabash cannonball.
Diz. That, folks, was Dizzy Dean in a new role, and this is Frank Eschen to inform you that you have just heard a special arrangement of the Wabash Cannonball by J. Hanner Dean, the Dean of the J.H. Dean Conservatory of Music. Jerome, I didn't know you could.
Maybe I can't, Frank, but I'm especially happy today, and I just busted out with it.
Well, now you can bust right out with your weekly parcel of advice for young ballplayers, Coach Dean.
That's fine, Frank. You know, I have kind of neglected the pitchers in these here advice departments, but I'm talking to the young pitchers today. Gather around, boys, and listen. Maybe I hope this will help you. I'm dividing the advice into two parts today. Number one, control, and number two, learn to pitch with men on bases. Control, I believe everybody will agree, is the most important asset to a pitcher can have. In fact, you just have to have it. And it's the old story of practice, fellas. But the thing to do is to start from the beginning, trying to throw every pitch at a particular target. Even when you warm up before a game, have your catcher hold his glove for a target. Try a half a dozen pitches at the low outside corner of the strike zone. Have the catcher hold the glove low and on the outside corner. Then aim half a dozen at the lower inside corner. Then pitch high and inside and then high and outside. Don't just throw to your catcher. Concentrate on every pitch, trying to put it where you want it. You can build a strike zone if you want to. Make a little window as wide as the plate and extended from the knees to the shoulders. Rig that up on a platform, maybe held in place by a rope. Then see how many pitches you can throw through that window. If you go through that trouble, I believe you'll get a big kick out of the fun you'll have throwing at the strike zone window. And now we come to number two again. Learn to pitch with men on base. You see, when there's nobody on base, you take your full windup. With a man on base, you got to pitch from a stretch. Many a pitcher who breaks into the big leagues does all right until somebody gets on base. Then when it can't take his windup no more, he loses some of his stuff, especially speed. It's a matter of practice again. It's a little harder to get all your power into your pitching when you can't take a windup. So you'll need a little more practice throwing that way.
Well, can you throw about as hard from the stretch as with a full windup, Diz?
Yes, just about, Frank. Although I believe our old friend psychology figures in that. When a pitcher goes through one of them long, fancy pump-handle windup, it kind of scares the hitter a little and makes it look like you're throwing harder than you really are. Of course, there comes a time when you can't throw as hard as you used to. I remember when I was with the Cubs, and old Gabby Hartnett come running out to the mound and says, "Diz, now try to throw this one a little harder." And I says, "Gabby, I'm throwing twice as hard as I ever thrown in my life." And Gabby looks at me kind of funny, and I says, "Gabby, the only trouble is that I throw hard enough, but I can't throw fast enough no more."
But Diz, with everything even, that is, with two men with equal strength, the form, the rhythm does make a difference.
Just like in golf, Frank, Ben Hogan ain't very big, but how he can send them a mile down the fairway.
Well, this little discussion leads right into an item from the mailbag, Jerome.
Okay, let's have it.
James Stewart of Boston wants to know if you formed any definite opinion about who deserves the Rookie of the Year honors for 1948.
Yes, I've been watching a lot of good-looking young ball players this season, Frank. Now I'll give Mr. Stewart a couple of candidates in each league. That ought to be definitely enough. In the National League, I'll name Alvin Dark of the Boston Braves and Richie Asburn of the Phillies. Dark has made a big difference in the Braves. He's tightened that infield defense. He's helped turn double plays, and he's helped with his hitting. Asburn probably would be a cinch for that honor if he come up with the Braves or the Cardinals. But it hurts a fellow to be with a club that ain't in the pennant race. But that Asburn has been a great little outfielder all year. He started by crowding Harry Walker to the bench, and he's up with the leaders at hitting.
Well, Diz, now about the American League's outstanding rookies.
They're pitchers, Frank. One is Lou Brissy of the Athletics, and the other is Gene Bearden of the Cleveland Indians. And it's been such a close race between the two that the pennant races may decide it. But I don't see anybody in the American League close to Bearden and Brissy.
And, Diz, here's another letter before we finish with the mailbag department. Mr. Ralph Adams of Pasadena, California, wants you to name Dizzy Dean's all-star big league team. That is, the best players in each position that you've played against or seen during your years as player and observer of big league baseball.
I'll be glad to accommodate, Mr. Adams. Mind you, I don't say these are the greatest ever. Just the best I've ever seen in action. I'll start with the infield. Lou Gehrig is my first baseman. I don't think there'll be any argument there. And at second base, which wasn't so easy, I'll take old Frankie Frey. Frank could win a game for you all by himself. He'd beat out an infield hit, steal second and third if he had to. Then he'd score on an infield out. A great man on bases, a good switch hitter, and a great defensive man. I know there'll be a lot of votes for Roger Hornsby, but I'll take Frey because there wasn't anything Frankie couldn't do. Playing next to Frankie on my team is Lou Boudreau. He's shown me a lot of shortstop this season and the last few seasons. He's been right up there near the top in hitting all year. And all the time, he's been managing the Cleveland Indians. I really don't think there ought to be no argument about Boudreau at shortstop. At third base, I guess we'll all vote together. Ty Trainer. Now, there was a third baseman. Tall, able to grab those high-line drives. Trainer was a great defensive man. You couldn't get anything through him. And he had a great arm. How do you like my infield, Frank?
Well, sounds like a great help to the pitcher, Diz. I don't think many would filter through that defensive line. Now, how about your outfield?
I know I'm going to hear a lot of squawks on this department, Frank. Maybe we ought to drop the whole thing.
Oh, no, Diz. Let's be brave about this. Let's have your outfield.
All right. Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, and Stan Musial. I know the first question will be, how about Ty Cobb? Well, I didn't see Ty Cobb, and I didn't see Chris Speaker. But I have seen Joe DiMaggio and Stan Musial. And Babe Ruth couldn't be left off of nobody's ball club.
Well, that's not a bad outfield, is he? Now, how about your catchers?
I'm going to pick two, Frank. With either one, I wouldn't need anybody else. But I'm picking Gabby Hartnett and Jimmy Wilson, the two greatest catchers I've ever seen behind the plate. And I've pitched them both.
Now we have everything but a pitching staff, Jerome.
Carl Hubble and Lefty Grove, Frank. Hubble was one of the greatest I ever seen anywhere. He had the greatest butterfly curve ever pitched. And Grove was tops in the American League as far as I could see.
Say, but you've named only left-handers, Jerome. How about a good right-hander now?
I just can't seem to think of any good right-hander, Frank.
Well, I tell you what, I'll think for you, Dizzy. How about Jerome Herman Dean? Do you think you could stand to have him on your team?
Well, I always did, Frank.
Now, Dizzy Dean, how about you becoming the storyteller?
I got a couple about umpires, Frank. Baseball fans seem to be interested in what goes on down on the ball field. Things that occasionally cause rows between umpires and players.
Sounds interesting. Go on.
And, of course, when you think of umpires and their rows, Frank, you think right quick of Frankie Frisch. He had many a row with the boys in blue. There was a time in Boston. We was playing the Braves, and it did seem that a lot of close plays was going against us. But Frank was in pretty good humor that day, and he wasn't raising no fuss. Then all of a sudden, Larry Goetz gets red in the face and chases Frank off the field. Nobody could figure what had happened.
Ah, but I'm sure Frisch regaled you with the details as he hid in the back of that dugout.
He sure did. Goetz was calling them at first base while Frank was coaching over at third. Well, after the third or fourth close one called against us, Frank walks past Goetz on the way to our dugout. He stops and says, "Goetz, it's a nice day, isn't it, Lawrence?" And Goetz says, "Yes, Frank, a beautiful day." And Frank says, "By the way, Lawrence, have you a couple of cigars in your pocket?" And Goetz says, "No, Frank, why would you think I'd have cigars in my pocket?" And Frisch says, "Because, Lawrence, you look so much like a cigar store Indian."
And Frisch got bounced just for that?
He sure did. Goetz didn't waste no time. That Frisch knew more ways of getting the umps mad. One day in Brooklyn, it was getting dark, and Frank thought the game ought to be called. You see, we was a run ahead. Anyhow, our pitcher got into a little trouble, and Frank sent the groundkeeper after a flashlight and started down to the bullpen, flashing the light so he could find his way.
Well, did Frank get bounced for that one?
Yes, George Major Kirk showed Frank the way to the clubhouse that time.
And another time when Frank thought the game ought to be called on account of rain, he got a big wagon umbrella and walked back and forth in front of the dugout, and he got bounced again.
And yet, Diz, they tell me Frisch and the umpires are the very best of friends.
They are, Frank. You see, Frisch never gets vicious. It's all good, clean fun, and the umpires have to laugh, too. But, of course, them umpires got dignity, and they got to protect that.
Yes, and they have a job to do.
That's right, Frank. Just like everybody else in baseball. Like the day we was playing the Phillies at the old Baker Bowl, late in September. The Phillies was down in last place, and we got off to an early lead. It wasn't much of a ball game, and the small crowd kept getting smaller and smaller. But we noticed one crowd of people down the right field stands, and they stayed inning after inning. Not one of them left the ballpark. Finally, we got curious, and I says, I'm going to the bullpen to warm up a little, and I'm going to find out what them people are staying to the finish of this ball game. So I go to the bullpen in the right field corner of the park, and when I pass the group that was sticking to the finish, I ask how come that they should stay so faithfully with us leading the Phillies 17-2. But they told me, Dizzy, they said, we know this is a pretty bad ball game, and we'd like to go home like everybody else is doing, but we can't. You see, we're the ground crew.
Well, now, Diz, before your last job on this series of programs for Johnson's Carnew...
Doggone, that's right. This is my last program for Carnar this summer.
And we should say thank you for listening.
And thanks for all them letters.
And we hope we'll be back again for Carnew next summer.
Stop, Frank, or you'll have me crying. I don't like to say goodbye. Well,
neither do I, Diz, so before we sign off for the summer, let's have Dizzy Dean, the reporter, give us the picture as you see it on the pennant races as they go into that final stretch.
Well, Frank, one of the races is about over. The Braves have a comfortable lead, and Billy Southworth has put the job on of protecting that lead into the hands of his two pitching stars. That's a smart move. Johnny Sane and Warren Spahn can do a little extra work till that flag is cinched, and then have time to rest before the World Series.
All right, and how about the American League, Diz?
That may go right down to the wire, Frank, but the Yankees are within easy striking distance. They may be some World Series games at Yankee Stadium in October. Watch them, Frank. If those Yankees ever get ahead, the Red Sox won't catch them again.
Ah, those are words of wisdom, Jerome. Words of wisdom indeed. Now, friends, before closing, just a brief rundown of Dizzy Dean's All-Star team pick today. First base, Lou Gehrig. Second, Frankie Frisch. Shortstop, Lou Boudreau. Third base, Pi Trainer. In the outfield, Stan Musial, Joe DiMaggio, and Babe Ruth. The catchers, Gabby Hartnett and Jimmy Wilson, and the pitchers, Carl Hubble, Lefty Grove, and of course, the one and only Dizzy Dean. He's been brought to you by Johnson's Carnew, a wax-fortified auto polish that cleans and polishes your car in one easy application. Rub it on, wipe it off. That's all there is to it. Rub it on and Carnew cleans your car, loosens up that sticky, stubborn road film that water won't touch. Wipe it off and Carnew polishes your car. Ask for Johnson's Wax Fortified Carnew today. You'll save your arms, you'll save your time, while you're making your car sparkle like new. Because remember, to give your car that Sunday shine, rub it on and wipe it off is all you do with Carnew.
This is Old Diz saying goodbye for now. I've had a lot of fun pitching across for Johnson's Carnew.
This is Frank Eschen saying the same thing for the makers of Johnson's Wax Fortified Auto Polish, Carnew. This program came to you from KSD St. Louis. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
And there you have two episodes of the 1948 Dizzy Dean Show from July 17 and September 18. Thanks for listening. If there are old-time radio shows you remember and would like to hear again, or if you just like to talk about old-time radio, drop me a note, Dan, D-A-N, at radiofun.info, I-N-F-O. Thanks for listening. In the Old Time Radio Corner, I'm Dan Hughes.